Welcome to Hungry for Answers with me, Robin Clare, recovery coach professional. Do you love food, alcohol, drugs, sex, social media, cigarettes, or gambling a little too much? The traditional narrative says that addiction to these vices is the problem. The truth is, they are just symptoms. This hit show takes you from recovery to your ultimate life as my special guests and I help you discover how underneath every vice is the addiction to the suffering that developed due to unhealed trauma. So what can you do? Hungry for Answers provides groundbreaking, proven solutions from my best-selling spiritual book, Feast and Famine, Healing Addiction with Grace. It's time to stop suffering and start living your ultimate life. You have a divine right to a life filled with love, joy, peace, and abundance. Hungry for Answers starts now. Hello, this is Robin Clare, and welcome to Hungry for Answers. So this is a second part of a very interesting topic that I have here with my guest, Dr. Susan Averna. On June 3rd, we did our first episode on food disorders, the hidden epidemic. And because it was such an important topic, there are 30 million people in the United States right now struggling with food disorders. And it's been in all the headlines about how food disorders have just skyrocketed because of the isolation of COVID-19. So we thought that we would spend two episodes doing this. And in this episode, if you haven't listened to the first one, don't worry about it, because we're going to review some really important stuff and then we're going to dive deeper. But if this topic is really important to you, eating disorders, I would highly recommend that you go back and listen to the June 3rd episode. So I have my special guest, Dr. Susan Averna. And Susan is my friend, my colleague. She's a developmental psychologist. She's a yoga teacher and an addiction researcher. And so welcome to the show, Susan.
Thanks, Robin. It's great to be back. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. So let's go over just some of the information from last time, and then we'll dive a little deeper. So can you tell us what are some of the three most common forms of food disorders, and how would you recognize them in yourself and others?
Sure. So I think of eating on a continuum. So there we have sort of what I would think of as a healthy relationship with food, which is eating when we're hungry or eating for enjoyment, and eating for nourishment, right? And then there's emotional eating, which is also not disordered, but where we're really looking for some other need to be met there. Maybe we're bored or we're nervous or whatever it is. But then that can move more toward a disordered or an unhealthy relationship with food, where we start to use food as really a way to self-soothe or as a crutch. And it can become problematic in our lives and start to create more problems because of the behaviors we're engaging in. And that's where the disordered part comes in. So the three primary disorders are anorexia, bulimia, and binge eating disorder. Mm-hmm. And anorexia primarily is where the person is restricting food intake to the point where they're losing a significant amount of weight, or they're not gaining weight as they should if it's a person who's still growing. But along with that is usually some body image issues, some beliefs about body and weight and food, and often sort of rules that are created around what is okay or not okay to eat. So that kind of all kind of comes together. And a fear of gaining weight. With bulimia, there's also the fear of gaining weight, and there's also these cognitive distortions and body image issues. The primary difference there is that the person engages in binging, which is eating a large amount of food in a discrete period of time, and usually feeling pretty awful after doing that. There might be some shame, regret, remorse, guilt, and an urge to kind of undo that behavior and make it okay. So there's always a compensatory behavior that follows, which might take the form of purging through vomiting, through laxative use, through over-exercising, or through going back into that restrictive mode like you can sometimes see in anorexia. And that becomes a vicious cycle because it actually sets the person up for more binging. And then typically what you see is this binge purge cycle. With binge eating disorder, there's the binge component without the compensatory behavior. So there's still the bad feelings that come after, the remorse, the regret. It wasn't the person's intent to really do that, although it served a purpose when they did, but there is no compensatory behavior. So those are the three that are generally recognized.
Thank you. So I'm curious, I want to get your opinion on this. I had listened to the CD series. It's also a book, Women, Food, and God by Janine Roth. Mm-hmm. And in it, she talked about this idea of obsessive compulsive food disorder. Mm-hmm. And that's what I sort of diagnosed myself as when I heard this on the CDs that I listened to. But I'm wondering if obsessive compulsive food disorder is the same thing as binge eating, or could they be slightly different?
So to really get at your question, just let me back up for a second. To understand this is just a group of people that came together to create, give a label to a set of behaviors. So it's not like people neatly fall into one category. You could have elements of one and not others. I would still call that disordered eating if it's interfering with your life. So certainly a lot of people have a sort of an obsessive or compulsive tendency, maybe in their personality or in their life, that is going to be a huge risk factor and play a big role in how they see food and their relationship with food. So we can try to discern, no, it's this disorder or not that disorder, but really that's an artificial distinction that mm-hmm. researchers make and that clinicians make in order to give a diagnosis. And there's good reason for that, because we want a common language. We want to know what we're talking about. We want to be able to operationally define so that we can do research. And for insurance purposes, we need a label or a diagnosis for reimbursement. But in the real world, it doesn't work that way. You know, you can have all these tendencies. So you might, in psychiatry, you often see people saying, well, it's, say, anorexia is comorbid with depression, or it's comorbid with OCD. Well, is it? I mean, it's really that there's something underlying that is creating these tendencies. And maybe that is temperamental, or maybe that's from early experience. So yes, you can see it all and you can kind of define it however you want. And if you're trying to make a distinction, I don't know how useful that is to do.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so what does the term comorbid mean?
Just that they're co-occurring. So a lot of times if you have someone that gets a diagnosis of bulimia or anorexia, it's not uncommon to also get a diagnosis of an anxiety disorder or depression or obsessive mm-hmm. compulsive disorder or obsessive compulsive personalities. And again, it's more, in my opinion, I'm sure there are people out there, clinicians might call up and disagree, but in my opinion, it's more of an artificial distinction. And actually your other part of your question was, how do you recognize these disorders? And I think when you start to see the elements of them, you see that they cross these labels or these diagnostic distinctions. You can see these symptoms appear in many. And that is because all of these behaviors are on a continuum of from normal to extreme. So there's nothing really in here. And that's true of the entire DSM. That's true of every symptom of every diagnostic category, that all of us do some of these things some of the time to some degree. And really, where, at what point does it cross a line where it becomes problematic? That's really where you have to be concerned. So for anorexia, for instance, what are some of the signs? Clearly, if you see someone losing a significant amount of weight in a short period of time, that would be a red flag. If you saw someone, what would restricting food look like? Well, maybe they're just, I'm never hungry. I'm not hungry. Oh, I already ate, or I'm going to eat later, or they're moving food around their plate and not really eating. That could be potentially a sign. They're wearing clothes to hide the fact that they've lost a lot of weight. Or you might hear it in their inner critical voice. So the comments that they make about themselves or about others, particularly if it's around body image and weight. So everyone does that. Well, not everyone, but many people do that. So that's not specific to anorexia, but it could be. Looking more at bulimia, again, the binge eating, and this is true for binge eating disorder, we talked about this last time, it's highly shameful and therefore highly secretive. So you're not likely to see someone engaging in a binge unless the context normalized it somehow, like maybe everyone's gorging themselves at Thanksgiving dinner or whatever. But typically you don't see that. People are doing this in private, but you might see evidence of it. So maybe a lot of food goes missing all of a sudden. Like, wait, we just had a gallon of ice cream and we don't anymore. Yeah. I didn't eat that, you know? And I'm not saying you should try to track or trace people either, because that just feeds the shame. But just talking about in terms of the evidence itself, you might see, you know, just wrappers and things of food that's been consumed and go, huh, what's, that's interesting. Obviously,
It was interesting for me when I was binge eating, like I would leave the living room and go to the kitchen all the time.
Yes.
At night. And,
and you have a little here and a little there and a little there.
Yeah. I mean, I would pass in front of Ori, my husband, and I mean, there were some times he didn't even notice that I had gone to the kitchen like 10 times. Yeah. And for me, especially the last time I binged, which I couldn't help it. I kept going. And then I came upstairs and I had a bulimic episode, which led to bleeding from my nose and pain in all of my organs. And I knew my body was saying enough is enough.
Yeah.
So it was a very scary situation. So we're going to be heading to a break soon. And maybe just chat for a minute or so about how to recognize it in yourself if you have an eating disorder.
Okay, sure, yeah. It's when these behaviors begin to interfere with the things that you want to do in your life, when you begin to restrict yourself from social gatherings or getting together with friends, or you're making choices based on the fear of maybe binging, or because you want to binge and you want to be in private, or in terms of anorexia, maybe you just don't want to be around food. Or if the thoughts that you're having are so intensely inner critical that you're just feeling terrible about yourself all the time. Again, the inner critic is a normal thing. We all have it, but there's extremes. So those are some of the things that I would think about if your life is being negatively impacted because of your fears around weight gain, weight loss, eating. That is a pretty good indication that things have gotten out of control. This is not a simple diet or lifestyle choice anymore. It's really running your life.
And I would agree with you on that. And I would also say that when food, even the conversation in your head around food becomes the most important conversation that you're having in your head or with others. Right. It's upset you when you're obsessing about it, either in a restrictive way or in a binge way. So we're going to go to break now. You're listening to Hungry for Answers with Robin Clare and my guest, Dr. Susan Averna, and we'll be right back.
You've been listening. But are you watching? Tune in to your favorite shows on the Transformation Talk Radio Facebook page. We stream live video podcasts every day. Can't get enough of I've Soul Radio? Join psychic medium Jamie every Thursday at 5 p.m. Pacific, 8 p.m. Eastern on Transformation Talk Radio. Take a deeper look at the raw side of spirit. Nothing is off limits. Connect with lost loved ones and explore these vulnerable subjects with the compassionate guidance of psychic medium Jamie. You are not alone. Eye of Soul, Thursdays at 5 p.m. Pacific, only on TransformationTalkRadio.com.
What we've been taught and told is not all there is. Life is all about energy, and the energy you feel is real. Tune into The Energy Paradigm each month on TransformationTalkRadio.com with Dr. Vic. The Energy Paradigm is an eye-opening, mind-shifting, transformative, and earth-shattering way to live, work, and do business that will enable you to unlock your magic every day. Visit TheEnergyParadigm.com.
You know, marriage is not always easy, but skills that improve communication go a long way. Tune in to the Relationship Rehab Show, Recovering Happiness in Your Love with Nancy Landrum and Dr. Pat each month on TransformationTalkRadio.com. Nancy is an author and teacher empowering couples to create and sustain loving marriages. Learn to listen, speak, and handle conflict with respect so your love can flourish. To learn more about Nancy and her work, visit NancyLandrum.com.
Hi, I'm Laura Goldstein, and here's a Coffee with the Universe tip. Ever wonder why you want to go to the gym more, for example, but you just can't make it happen? You find yourself rearranging your underwear drawer instead of getting in the car. If this sounds like you, you might have caught a case of the shoulds. Maybe you think you should lose 20 pounds to fit back into your favorite pair of jeans, or that you should be healthier in general. It all sounds good, but deep down you just aren't into it. Truth is, making choices from shoulds just leads to guilt, resentment, and a whole lot of procrastination. So take a good look at your goals. Are you shoulding yourself anywhere? If so, give yourself permission to let it go. For more insights like this, tune into my Transformation Talk radio show called Coffee with the Universe. It's a live call-in show. I'd love to support you.
Hello, you're listening to Hungry for Answers with me, Robin Clare. If you'd like to learn more about my work, please go to clarity.com. That's clare-ity.com. And I'm here with Dr. Susan Averna. And Susan, can you share with our audience how they can connect with you?
Yes, of course. You can reach me on my Facebook page called Witness and Wonder and message me through there. Or you can reach me through email at susanaverna@comcast.net.
That's great. That's great. So continuing the conversation on eating disorders, the hidden epidemic. So I'd like to ask you, Susan, what do you think is at the core of this eating disorder epidemic?
I think that underlying eating disorders is shame. I think there's shame is a huge component, and that can come from a few different places. Trauma in particular, developmental trauma perhaps, and I can let me back up and define trauma for you. So the way I define it, because people can define it in different ways, I define trauma as any event or experience that overwhelmed the person beyond their capacities or their resources. So that's okay. Pretty general. So it doesn't need to have been some horrific incident. It doesn't need to have been abuse or neglect. Those are certainly traumatic developmental experiences. Instead, it's really anything that the person wasn't able to handle. So think of that sort of as a child who maybe is in a family where the whole family is overwhelmed. And the parents are doing the best they can, but they're also overwhelmed. And they're not being able to handle their own experiences. So that's sort of the intergenerational part of this, of trauma. So that is sort of a setup right there, is that if the person has this unresolved trauma, they are going to be dysregulated. Their body is not going to be in a state of regulation where they feel sort of optimal and able to move throughout their life in the best way. And we move in and out of a state of regulation all the time. But someone who has experienced trauma is either stuck in dysregulation or they get tripped into it very, very easily and overwhelmed into it. And so then the body is seeking for ways to come back into regulation. And there's the food. So people use all kinds of ways, and it's not typically conscious. It's really biologically driven, particularly in the beginning. And they might reach for a drink. And oh, that feels good to the body. And they might not even be thinking that, like, oh, I'm going to drink now every time I'm anxious. It just happens. And the same thing can happen with food, is that, you know, we're going along and we're trying to eat in these normal ways. And then we're very, very stressed and dysregulated. And we find that these practices or these behaviors that we're engaging in are self-soothing in some way. And of course, it's not just that, because we live in a culture that's, you know, I think culturally we don't have a good relationship with food, and there's a lot of junk out there and a lot of food that can really bring our bodies into a less healthy state as well. So then there's all the messaging about body and weight. So we were constantly bombarded about how we should look, right. And these standards that are unattainable. And we're getting that messaging from a really young age. So even if we're not consciously taking that in, it's influencing how we think about ourselves, the relationship we have with ourselves, how we think we measure up to other people. Our worth becomes very externalized in that way. So all of this together can create this, what we're seeing now as an epidemic.
So I'd like to share with you, Susan, and our audience, for me, you know, someone that struggled for 40 years with disordered eating. Mm-hmm. I've tracked my journey back to when I was 7 years old, and my grandmother suggested to my mom that I go on a diet. And so I was at summer camp, and my counselor said that, you know, everybody else can have regular dessert, but I'd have to have Jell-O. Surprise, I still like Jell-O after that. But yeah. It was mortifying. It was mortifying to be singled out like that, mm-hmm. and to not be able to be so restricted to have a dessert that I can still, to this day, no matter how much work I've done around it, I can still see my little 7-year-old self running out of the dining room and crying in the little cul-de-sac there in front of the dining room and feeling so humiliated and ashamed. And I believe that set the tone for many more times when I would be humiliated. And when I was, I would look for food. And so it became this cycle of humiliation, shame, mm-hmm. eating, purging, and then it just it happened over and over again. And so I would really talk to parents about that, about putting children on diets per se,
have some compassion for 7-year-old you.
Yes, for sure.
How much pain that was, but also for your mom or for the other well-meaning adults in your life who were doing this out of love and care, mm-hmm. and concern, and really thought it was the best thing. And probably the messaging came from through them from somewhere else. And so we are all suffering and we're all doing the best we can. And so when someone has experienced, you don't get through this life without experiencing trauma, at least the way I've defined it, right?
No.
So
yes.
We're all suffering in this way. So none of this is meant to be sort of judging of parents. I know I'm messing this up constantly with my kids. I'm sure that I am.
Right.
But I also have a level of self-awareness to repair and to kind of reset when I notice that maybe I made a comment I shouldn't have made, or whatever. Maybe I'm modeling something I wish I hadn't. And so, you know, I have nothing but compassion for parents as we're trying to, you know, do the best we can with our kids. But you're right. The messaging is not just coming from parents, it's coming from everywhere. Mm-hmm. And at a very young age, and the research is horrifying to show, you know, girls as young as 8, 9 years old, and probably younger, getting really receiving these messages and worrying about their weight and worrying about their body shape. So it really is a setup in that way. But you said it, the core is the beliefs about yourself. You felt humiliated. You were shamed. And shame, I want to make a distinction, because guilt is I did something bad. Shame is I am bad.
Right.
And that's a tough one to unravel, because you can repair guilt. You can make amends, right? But if it's who I am, and if I truly believe at my core there's something wrong with me, that's a tough one. And that can lead to a lot of addictive behaviors to kind of smooth that over. And in my own recovery story, I can say that the turning point for me was when I disclosed this to my husband, mm-hmm. who I think I was engaged to at the time. We'd been together for a while, but he didn't know. And of course, it had created all kinds of problems in our relationship, because I was behaving in these bizarre ways that he didn't understand. And I couldn't explain it because I was too ashamed to explain it. But when I was able to say, this is what I'm doing, this is what I'm feeling, and he was able to hold that with just love and no judgment, that was a huge turning point. And I told therapists, but it's not the same as telling someone who knows you and they still totally accept you, flaws and all. And so I would really encourage the listeners, if you're suffering or you know someone who is, and I get it, you don't want to say this aloud because it feels too shameful, find one person that you trust with this information to be able to say it to, because it was like just the weight was lifted off. And of course, it wasn't an overnight recovery, but that was a huge, huge turning point for me.
Yeah, I would agree with you. That was for me too. When I spoke to my husband, Ori, about it, it just felt like I wasn't alone anymore.
Yeah.
And it really did make a difference. So let's look at another question. So we can see why food disorders went off the charts in COVID-19, right? Mm-hmm. We were alone. That's a good one for people who are binging, right? we were scared. Everybody was scared. We were isolated. And so, you know, now that we're getting back into more normal living, you would agree that if you were struggling with this through COVID, you really just need to look at this with professional help. And even though it's, you're like, oh, we're back to normal now, it's going to go away, it doesn't necessarily go away on its own. Would you agree?
I would absolutely agree. Yeah. I mean, I think COVID probably was a trigger for a lot of people. Just the threat, when we are under threat, whether it's a real physical threat or an emotional threat, a threat to our self-worth, you know, we go into these sort of defensive modes and look for ways to soothe that. And the ways in which we typically look, if we don't have the resources within ourselves, we look to others to co-regulate us. But everybody was under this threat. And now we're in close quarters, and that might have been nice for a little while, but you know, routines were disrupted, people were stressed, people had financial insecurity, there was all kinds of issues to kind of make it so that we weren't able to co-regulate each other as well as maybe we would in another context. And so people, again, the body is really creative, will look for ways to come back into regulation. And for some people that was eating, you know, in a disordered way. For some people might have been using substances or other problematic behaviors, and it won't just stop, most likely, for a lot of people.
It's not a problem of willpower, right?
Oh, no. In fact, I was thinking about this. Some people with eating disorders have incredible willpower. If you think about people who are restricting, the willpower it takes to do that, obviously it can blow up on you. But yeah, it is not a matter of willpower. It's not a matter of white knuckling it, trying harder. In fact, the work that I do around self-compassion, I first have to educate people that self-compassion doesn't make you weaker. It actually gives you more willpower in the sense that it's an alternative. You don't have to be so harsh on yourself. There's studies that show that when people are harsh to control their behaviors, if they're harsh, if they're self-critical, if they're berating, that does not work in the long. It might work in the short term for a little while, but in the long term, they will. It's an increased threat to self. Now you're just creating more threat internally through your dialogue, and therefore you're more likely to keep engaging in the bad behaviors that you're trying to stop doing.
Yeah.
If you bring a self-compassionate response, the opposite happens. The threat comes down, and you have more choice, and you have an ability to maybe go in a different direction. So yeah, I do think that some people might be able to come out of this okay, but a lot of people are going to need a little support, and that's okay, because there's nothing wrong here. That we're suffering, we're making these choices to soothe the suffering, and that's not working for us anymore. And so we need some help to maybe replace those behaviors with something that works a little bit better.
So we need to go to break now.
Yeah.
Okay. So you're listening to Hungry for Answers with Robin Clare and Dr. Susan Averna, and we'll be right back. Tune into Hungry for Answers every first and third Thursday at 9 a.m. Pacific, 12 p.m. Eastern on TransformationTalkRadio.com with me, Robin Clare. I am a recovery coach, professional, and best-selling author, bringing you eye-opening conversations about addiction and groundbreaking tools for recovery. To learn about me and my offerings, visit Clarity.com. That's Clare, Clare-ity.com.
Parenting isn't about perfection. I think we all know that. Parenting is about being present and honest, having compassion for your child and for yourself, communicating consciously and loving unconditionally. Tune into the Awakened Parent Project with Susan Dolce every first and third Tuesday at noon Pacific on TransformationTalkRadio.com. Learn to be an empowered parent through the techniques of the Conscious Parenting Community. To learn more about Susan, visit SusanDolce.com.
Hey everyone, I hope you're enjoying the new year. During this time of need, I've been called to offer my life coaching services for free. That's right, free, no strings attached. Ram Dass said it best, we're all walking each other home. I'd like to support your walk with my coaching skills. To start the process, hit me up at miles2gocoaching.com. And under Book Online, select Is Coaching Right for Me? After that, we'll schedule time to meet and map out whatever you want to work on. I look forward to hearing from you. And remember, you can catch me on Transformation Talk Radio the second and fourth Wednesday at 1 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. Eastern. See you soon.
Get empowered. Transformation Talk Radio. Imagine what it would be like to turn your pain into purpose. Tune in to Transformation with Martinet every second and fourth Friday at 10 a.m. Pacific on TransformationTalkRadio.com. Martinet and her guests are here shining their lights today through empowering stories of hardship and transformation. Begin to see your life in a new light. Visit martineemmons.com and tune in every second and fourth Friday at 10 a.m. Pacific to Transformation with Martinet.
Hello, this is Robin Clare, and you're listening to Hungry for Answers. Welcome back. If you'd like to learn more about my work, please go to clarity.com. That's Clare-ity.com. And I have Dr. Susan Averna here with me. Susan, can you share how people can connect with you?
Yes, you can reach me on my Facebook page, Witness and Wonder, and through email at susanaverna@comcast.net.
Thank you. So I wanted to share a story with you, Susan. When I went to a naturopath to help with my eating disorder, you know, while I was still doing therapy. And one of the things that she did is she did my blood work, but she checked for the dopamine levels in my brain, and I had none. I wasn't producing it on my own. And when we discovered that I didn't have dopamine, which is maybe a chemical that makes you be able to feel joy within yourself, we were like both of us jumping up and down in her office. We were so excited that there might have been a physical reason why I couldn't find joy and I was looking towards food. So what are your thoughts about the levels of dopamine and the biochemistry of the brain in relation to food disorders?
Yeah, so the food we eat impacts the neurotransmitters and how they're used in our body, and it's different for everyone. But the dopamine system in general is the reward system. It's also the motor system, but it's implicated in how we feel joy, like you said, or get reward from an activity. And if you were low on it, whether that could have been a result of years of eating a particular way, or it could have been something maybe biochemically that is just in you and your makeup, I can't say. But certainly our eating practices can sort of change our biochemistry in that way. So maybe the foods that you were eating were overloading the dopamine system such that now the neuroreceptors downregulate and you need more and more and you're just not getting what you need. That's one possibility. The other thing is the other neurotransmitters that are implicated in mood, and you see these affected through most of the psychiatric medications for depression and anxiety, are serotonin and norepinephrine. And the receptors for those are in the brain, but there's also actually more receptors in the gut. And there's a lot of research now to show that your microbiome really greatly affects these neurotransmitters and then therefore would affect your mood. And what you're eating, how that interacts with your microbiome would alter your mood as well. So there's a lot of biology behind this. And again, like I said, the body has an intelligence. And so you might have been seeking out certain behaviors to meet this lack of dopamine. And you're not consciously aware of that, but there is, as you found some that maybe gave you a boost, you know, you're gonna seek that out again and again and again. Or, you know, I'm not really sure what your story is, but that, so when we engage in behaviors over and over and over, let's just say, something becomes a habit, that changes your neurochemistry. It changes the wiring of our brain. Sure. That's what we call, you know, brain plasticity. And we know that that happens lifelong now. It's not something that's just happening in young children. The good news is that we can shift our behaviors and create new habits, and we can change our wiring for the good and maybe even rework our neurochemistry in that way. So for you, it's excellent if you find ways to replace or encourage the release of dopamine that wasn't happening before.
Yeah, and so I was able to do that through a natural supplement. I'm not even sure I'm allowed to say what they are out loud, but if anybody is feeling like maybe that could be a reason, they should seek out their naturopath and have the blood work and then go on a natural supplement. So we know that there could be very long-term impacts from disordered eating to your organs, to your state of mind, to all of these things. So let's start talking about solutions. Therapies, you know, you had said to me that you felt that people need a combination of talk therapy and body-centered therapy for healing from food disorder. So maybe talk about what are some of your favorite ways to recommend to your clients.
Well, I don't want to imply that you need anything in particular. I think every person is individual in their journey and what this disorder has looked like for them and what they might need to heal from it. What I was saying was that we know that there are aspects of talk therapy that can be very, very effective, but maybe not enough. And there are lots of more body-based therapies now that recognize the role of the body, in healing, particularly around trauma, but also for other disorders that might be related to trauma. So for instance, then there's all kinds of talk therapies too. So I'm not sort of promoting any one particular orientation or style over another. I think it's really what works for you. And there might be some trial and error in finding that. But you know, for some talk therapies, for instance, you're going to be really looking back at early experience and trying to get some insight and make those connections. Mm-hmm. And that can be very healing when you do that, because that can release some of the shame, or it can give you a coherence that you didn't have before. But what we also know is that particularly with trauma, that's not typically enough, because although you make sense of it and you have a story that kind of makes sense, it's in the body, it's in the tissues, it's in the cells. It's in the cells, it's in body memories and what I would call, and other people, implicit memories, body-based memories. So that when you get triggered, let's say there's something in your environment that brings up some awful feeling. I don't know, maybe somebody serves Jell-O and you go, I don't know why, but I just feel really awful all of a sudden. I mean, that's an implicit memory that's coming over you. You may not even have a conscious autobiographical memory attached to it where I say, oh, I know that this is related to that. All you know is suddenly you've had a shift in mood. You don't feel well, or you feel maybe you're angry or agitated. So that's what I mean when these body-based memories come up. And those don't necessarily go away with talk therapy. And maybe they can, and maybe they can't. But what I have seen is that there's some other approaches. And it doesn't even have to be within the realm of psychology and psychologically based body-based therapies. I mean, I've seen some wonderful things in all kinds of traditions using the body, energetic medicine, Tai Chi, Qigong, anything that can kind of move the body in a way that you are almost repatterning. So it's really cool stuff, and I don't know how long we have to get into it. I know that I mentioned yoga last time, and what I love about yoga is the therapeutic aspects of yoga. There are many, but when you go toward the more gentle, slowing down, inquiry-based yoga practices, where the movement isn't about getting the right pose or just aligning the self in a particular way, it's really about using that to explore the sensations that come up in the body and the dialogue that comes up, right? Because there's a lot of chatter. It can be really revealing. And it's a practice used to hold that with curiosity and compassion rather than judging it or reacting and being in our old reactive ways. Another piece of yoga that I love is the breath work or the pranayama, because there is, in my experience, really no other more powerful way to change your physiology in the moment than altering and consciously using your breath. And yes. So we can teach people to breathe differently at a very basic level. Just how do you breathe deeply and diaphragmatically, and how does that impact the stress or anxiety that you're experiencing? But there are also plenty of other breathing techniques that can be useful to people depending on how they would like to be able to shift their mood. But this gives the power back to the person. It's all about sort of agency, not control. And we don't want you to be controlling, but you want to feel in control, that you're not getting hijacked anymore by these thoughts or these emotions where you're reacting in a way that it's not your choice. Because that's kind of how it feels a lot when we engage. Yeah.
I also think, you know, we are mind, body, spirit, and emotion. And if we were to say, you know, which should be running the show, mind, body, spirit, and emotion, I would really say that body should be the last that's running the show. I don't think our bodies want to run the show, but when we have trauma, it seems that our bodies take over the experience. And we are not our trauma. We are not our experiences. We are really basically a soul being having a human being experience. And if we can get back to that understanding that these are just experiences that perhaps even our soul wanted to experience in this lifetime so that we could grow to become the people that we're intended to be, to perhaps fulfill our soul's destiny. If we can look at all of this trauma and experience as another form of education, so that we can heal from it and then perhaps serve others. Because you and I have both done that. We've taken our experiences, we've become educated on them, and now we help others to heal their own lives. So I would encourage everyone who's struggling to know, to say, you know what, this is an education for me, and what can I do with it? But you need to go, you need to have healing. And how you do it, as Susan said, is really up to you. Mm-hmm. What you want to do, how you want to go about it. But if you don't, you're going to just struggle. You're going to almost be obsessing about the trauma and the experiences if you're aware of them. If you're not aware of them, you're just going to be feeling like crap all the time and then looking to self-soothe. So we're going to be going to another break. And you're listening to Hungry for Answers with me, Robin Clare, and Dr. Susan Averna, and we'll be right back.
We remember a time when you could simply form a thought and it would manifest. The harmony was forgotten, but it is returning now. The Power of Inspiration and Awakening Radio with Julia Griffin on TransformationTalkRadio.com each second and fourth Wednesday at 9 a.m. Pacific will take you on adventures through the heart and spirit, exploring who we once were. This intuitive healer studied under the guidance of wolves, learning from their wisdom to master a higher frequency for a new state of mind. Visit OneTrueSelf.com.
We'd love to hear from you on Transformation Talk Radio and live on Facebook. Call into the show, 1-800-930-2819.
Are you living life, or is life living you? Tap into the divine love, healing, and wisdom already in you with Tea Lotus on Triple L, the Live Love Lotus Show, every first and third Friday at 12 p.m. Pacific, 3 p.m. Eastern on TransformationTalkRadio.com. To learn more about how to consciously create your most incredible life, join the Sacred Path online community. It's free. Visit thesacredpath11.com to join. That's thesacredpath11.com.
Are you ready to get big and live your life out loud? Tune in to Get Big Out Loud Radio, exploring life through the lens of curiosity and compassion, with me, Carrie Knudsen, joining Dr. Pat live every second Monday at 10 a.m. Pacific on TransformationTalkRadio.com. I will offer ideas to transform what you are thinking into conscious action. If you want to get big and live your life out loud, visit me at KnudsenSpeaks.com.
And so you're listening to Hungry for Answers with me, Robin Clare, and my guest, Dr. Susan Averna. And I just want to give away a copy of my book. And so my book is called Feast and Famine, Healing Addiction with Grace. It's a spiritual approach to healing eating disorders or any form of addiction. And so for the first caller, Olivia, my producer, actually, you could take the first three callers. I'll give three books away to the callers at 1-800-930-2819 to get a copy of my book, Feast and Famine, Healing Addiction with Grace. All right, so we're heading into our last segment, and I just have a really simple, complex question. Can eating disorders be prevented?
The short answer I would say is yes. I don't know that there's any particular preventative program that we would, that I would advise. But if we think about the factors that go into creating what ultimately looks like an eating disorder, I mentioned this in the last podcast, it's multifactorial. So there are going to be aspects of the individual that they bring into this world. And you mentioned this in the last segment, Robin, maybe that's for good reason. And maybe there is something to be learned there. And so maybe the goal isn't to prevent it. It's to work through it and to grow from it. Mm-hmm. These experiences, I just want to bring me back to this, but I want to make this point. I think language is powerful. And when we label something a disorder, we're pathologizing the behavior and maybe not intentionally, but we can pathologize a person. And I don't want people to feel that there's anything inherently wrong with them. This is really, it's just a way that you have chosen to move through your life to respond to the events and experiences and feelings that you're having in that moment. And yes, it can take on a life of its own and it can get out of control and you can feel trapped in it, but it's really just an experience you're moving through, and you can come out of this and you can grow and learn from it. And I know we talked about this last time with whether it's eating disorder, whether it's pain, there are gifts that come from this. There's no mm-hmm. way I would have been able to do some of the work that I'm doing with people if I hadn't experienced this myself. I couldn't have read about this in a textbook and had the same level of understanding and compassion if I hadn't experienced it firsthand. So maybe the goal isn't always to prevent, I guess, is what I'm saying there. But what could be different? What might change the circumstances such that someone would not experience this? We are now really recognizing the role of early trauma and how that creates all kinds of physical and mental yes. problems down the line. And so the more we recognize that and normalize that, trauma is not some big, scary thing, that awful thing. It's happening all the time. And the more we can normalize and go, okay, this is what happens, and here's how we know how to not just recover, but grow from it, the more that we will be able to not move into these other sort of behaviors.
Certainly. I also think I want to just make that point. Trauma, we don't know when we're having a traumatic experience. Sometimes we do because it's so obvious and it's so hurtful and destructive to us. But we also don't know when something is happening in our lives that is going to cause trauma to cause us to hang on to trauma. And I also want to reiterate when you said that the trauma kind of wreaks havoc on our lives if we don't clear it.
Yeah.
And you could probably say that beyond eating disorders, beyond any form of addiction, a lot of disease in our country is because we're holding on to this trauma, and we're holding on to the anxiety from it and stress from it. Yeah. So the more that we can do to relieve the trauma from our childhood, from our teen years, from our adult lives, to not remove it. Remove it is when I say remove it, I'm almost really, what I really mean is to understand it, maybe put out the emotional charge from it.
Yes.
And then integrate it into the rest of the landscape of our lives, where it isn't something that is overwhelming us or invading our thoughts all the time or stopping us from living our most full life that we can.
That is absolutely true. And a lot of the trauma treatments, that is the goal. It's not like you erase this memory from your life experience. You'll always have the memory that this incident happened or these experiences happened, but you nailed it when you said it doesn't hold the same charge. And so we start to separate those body experiences that are intolerable, that come up for us, whether it's sensation, emotion that overwhelms and dysregulates. Now we have that memory. Oh yes, that thing happened that time at camp when they said this thing. And you have that memory, it's still there, but it doesn't bring up that gut-wrenching feeling of humiliation and shame anymore. You've decoupled that in a sense. And so now you have that experience and you still have the compassion for that little girl, but you're not reliving it, and you're not needing to re-soothe that over and over and over through whatever behavior you choose to do that. And so in that way, these therapies are really rewiring the brain. They are changing the body and the body's response to memory.
Go ahead.
No, I wanted to just give a shout out to you, Robin, because I know you're a writing coach. And one really great therapy is narrative therapy and sort of rewriting your story. We think of our story as a static truth, but it's not. It's an interpretation. And I know for myself, if you had interviewed me at 25 years old about my eating disorder, first of all, I would never talk to you because I was too secretive and, you know, I wouldn't have been able to even speak of it. But let's say I could have. I was in a very blaming victim mode at that point. I was trying to make sense of it. I was suffering so much and trying, where did this come from? And why am I like I am? And now at my 50-year-old self, there's a wisdom there that came from experience. It came from becoming a parent myself and seeing, oh, this ain't as easy as it looks. You know, we all are flawed and we all make mistakes, and the sort of the grace that comes from that. So, you know, then my point about the narrative therapy is we can rewrite our story in a way with that brings in that level of understanding and compassion and forgiveness for all the parties involved, including especially us, for why we made the choices we made, and let go of some of that regret or remorse. So I think it can be really useful, and I'm glad that you give people the opportunity to do that.
Thank you. Yes. So what I do for the listeners, I'm a writing coach for people who are in recovery and who want to take their recovery story and use it as a tool to help heal others. And we do the writing. I call it writing the right recovery, the first part where you're just getting it all out of yourself so that it's not hidden inside of you anymore. And then if you're interested in creating a best-selling book, we then turn it into a manuscript. And so it's very exciting. I feel so incredibly blessed to be in people's stories like this. I don't take it lightly. It's a gift for me. And I feel so blessed to help them to do this. So we're heading into the end of the show. I'd love for everybody to check out Susan's Facebook page called Witness and Wonder. And if you'd like to connect with me and have a 30-minute conversation about consultation, free consultation about writing your own book, please come to clarity.com, CLARE-ITY. So listen, everybody, if you're struggling with addiction and know that healing and recovery is possible for you and that living your ultimate life is also possible for you. You can go for traditional help, professional help, or you can go inside and learn to connect with your own inner divinity. And so I'd like to thank you, Susan, for spending two episodes with me talking about this very personal topic for me, and I think very relevant topic for society, food disorders, the hidden epidemic. So thank you again for being here.
You're welcome. I'm grateful you invited me.
Yep. And so everybody, take care. And until the next time we're together, be well. Bye-bye. Thank you for tuning into Hungry for Answers. Learning to love ourselves is the one true solution to addiction. Make a commitment to healing today and see how you can reach your ultimate potential. Remember, you have a divine right to a life filled with love, joy, peace, and abundance. To learn more about me and my offerings, please go to clarity.com. That's Claire, CLARE-ITY.com. See you next time.
Views expressed on this program are those of the host, guests, and callers, and do not necessarily reflect the views of the station, its management, or advertisers. You're listening to Transformation Talk Radio.